The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 15th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has a couple of young adults, I'd say late 20s, maybe 30-ish, a man and a woman. They're actually leaning against each other back to back. The man has on a plaid shirt, jeans, a Republican button, and Make America Great Again hat. The woman, jeans and a T-shirt. She's got a little stocking cap on. She's got the Democratic donkey pin and a button that says, "My body, my choice." They both have kind of grimaces on their face and looking over their shoulders at each other. The headline is "Separate Worlds: How the Growing Political Gender Gap is Pushing Young Men and Women Apart." That story shows up on the Talking Points page, but we will start with the first main story. Haley exits after Trump's Super Tuesday romp. What happened? Donald Trump was poised this week to claim the Republican presidential nomination after a near sweep of crushing Super Tuesday wins led his sole remaining rival, Nikki Haley, to bow out of the race. The former president won 14 of 15 states, taking most by lopsided margins. He beat Haley by 60 points in Texas, 51 in North Carolina, and 40 points in Minnesota, racking up enough delegates to put him on track to clinch the nomination by month's end. Haley took her first state, Vermont, in a surprise win, but the next morning she suspended her campaign, saying she had no regrets about a run that allowed Americans to have their voices heard. She declined to endorse Trump, saying it's his job to earn her supporters' votes, adding, "I hope he does that." Trump struck a dark note after his Super Tuesday wins, claiming that under President Biden, his likely rival in November, our cities are choking to death, our states are dying, and frankly, our country is dying. Biden easily won Democratic primaries in every state, losing only in American Samoa, where a little-known entrepreneur took 51 votes to Biden's 40. His most formidable opponent was uncommitted votes from Democrats angered by his support of Israel's war in Gaza. In Minnesota, 20% of voters chose uncommitted, while no preference took 13% in North Carolina. Biden warned that reelecting Trump would lead the nation into chaos, division, and darkness. The likely Republican nominee, he said, is driven by grievance and grift, focused on his own revenge and retribution, not the American people. What the editorial said: the Republican Party has completed its transformation into a vessel for the fulfillment of Trump's ambitions, said the New York Times, and that's tragic for both the GOP and the nation. The party is now so deep in the thrall of an aspiring authoritarian that it has cast aside principle, policy, and patriotism, and lost whatever power it once had to hold him in check. With Trump ordained as their candidate, Republican voters now must decide whether to support someone who would do to the country what he has already done to his party. Get ready for America's great presidential unpopularity contest, said the Wall Street Journal. Biden's approval ratings have hit Jimmy Carter territory, and three-quarters of Americans think he's too old for a second term. But Trump is also widely disliked and will be bombarded by Democratic attacks over his disgraceful effort to overturn his 2020 loss to Biden and many other vulnerabilities. Trump also faces several criminal trials, with roughly a third of GOP voters polled this week saying a conviction would cost him their support. For the GOP, renominating such a checkered candidate is a gamble. What the columnist said. New national polls flash with warning signs for Biden, said Shane Goldmacher in the New York Times. In a Times Siena College poll, Trump leads him 48% to 43%, and only one in four voters say the country is moving in the right direction. Among voters who backed Trump in 2020, 97% plan to vote for him again in November, compared with only 83% of Biden's 2020 voters, with 10% saying they now back Trump. Trump's primary numbers suggest polling may be skewed, said Peter Spiegel in the Financial Times. He has consistently performed below pollsters' expectations, and in some cases, the differential is eye-popping. In Virginia, Trump polled 60 points ahead of Haley. He finished only 28 points ahead. In Vermont, a major poll showed Trump leading 61 to 31, and then he lost. The misfires suggest a growing number of secret non-Trump voters among Republicans, and they seem to be clustered in the suburban areas where the 2024 election will be won or lost. Thus begins a Biden-Trump rematch that a majority of Americans dread, said Jim Garrity in the Washington Post. Haley's respectable showing proved that some strain of non-Trump Republicanism still exists, and large numbers of Republican voters don't want the MAGA king as their nominee. Given Trump's stranglehold on the GOP base, she was probably doomed from the start. But if you're disgusted that the nation is stuck on a train careening toward a repeat of 2020 few seem to want, don't blame Haley. She did everything she could to pull the emergency brake. Controversy of the week. Supreme Court. Are the justices trying to help Trump? Donald Trump won big at the Supreme Court this week, said Sam Baker in Axios, and the ruling reinstating him into Colorado's primary ballot was the least of it. More consequential was the court's decision to hear arguments in late April on Trump's claim of total immunity for all official acts undertaken as president. A lower court flatly rejected that claim last month, and many legal experts had expected the justices to decline Trump's appeal, allowing his 2020 election subversion trial in Washington, D.C. to begin. But that case is now frozen until the high court issues a ruling, possibly in late June. And the defense and prosecution will then need several more months to prepare. It's unlikely the court will uphold Trump's audacious claim, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. But the justices' lethargic timing, special counsel Jack Smith first asked them to take up the issue in December, all but guarantees one of two terrible outcomes. Either the trial won't start until after the election, at which point a victorious Trump could be just weeks away from instructing his attorney general to dismiss the charges, or the trial could start this fall and Trump will insist it be postponed so he can campaign. Trump's immunity bid has always been a stalling tactic, and the conservative-dominated Supreme Court seems happy to play along. Actually, this is Trump's worst nightmare, said Jennifer Rubin, also in the Post. If the court rules in May, his January 6th trial could start in August, and a guilty verdict could drop in October, days before the election. Should a ruling land at the end of the court's term in late June, the campaign's close will be consumed with testimony about Trump's coup plotting. Yes, there's that Justice Department rule about not charging or targeting candidates in the last 60 days of a campaign. But trials that are all that are ready to go can start regardless of the campaign calendar. If a partisan court were really trying to help Trump, said National Review in an editorial, it could have quickly upheld his immunity claim or punted the question until its next term, as Trump requested. But the justices can move far faster when they want, said Harry Littman in the Los Angeles Times. The Colorado ruling came only 2 months after Trump requested a hearing, so it's fair to ask if the conservative justices are deliberately delaying the January 6th trial because polls show a criminal conviction would likely persuade a significant number of voters to abandon Trump. Slow or not, the justices had to take this appeal, said Lee Kovarsky in the New York Times. Trump's claims of immunity are implausibly broad, but so was the lower court's ruling that ex-presidents have zero immunity for their actions in office. In an age of extreme polarization, the Supreme Court must recognize some kind of qualified immunity for presidents, or they'll all be subject to frivolous, politicized prosecutions the moment they exited the White House. That includes President Biden, whom Trump is threatening to go after should he win in November. The lesson of this week is that no one is coming to save us from Trump, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. It's hard to accept that there's no mechanism to exclude from the White House someone of Trump's demonstrated criminality. But after the letdown of the Mueller report, the failure of two impeachment trials, and the dwindling likelihood of any criminal conviction by November, it's time to face the reality that a deus ex machina will not rescue our democracy. Trump will be defeated, if at all, in November at the ballot box. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for LeBron James, who last week became the first player in NBA history to score 40,000 career regular season points. I hated that it had to happen in a defeat, said the Los Angeles Lakers star, who hit a milestone during a 124-114 loss to the Denver Nuggets. It was a good week for anarchy, after dictionary publisher Merriam-Webster defied centuries of education and tradition with an Instagram post that declared, "It is permissible in English for a preposition to be what you end a sentence with." And it was a good week for tortured poets, after a new study revealed that Taylor Swift is related to Emily Dickinson. The pop superstar and 19th century poet are sixth cousins three times removed, according to Ancestry.com, and both descend from a 17th century English immigrant. But it was a bad week for prospects, after Texas Tech defensive back Tyler Owens, a standout at last week's NFL Combine, told reporters that he doesn't believe in space. Owens, 22, explained that he's real religious, and so I don't think there's other planets and other stuff like that. It's a bad week for strongmen, after former Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro denied allegations that he harassed a humpback whale in his speedboat. Bolsonaro, 68, said that a police investigation into his suspected whale bothering is part of a campaign of relentless persecution. Finally, it was a bad week for having nice things, after the Philadelphia Phillies ended their long-running $1 hot dog nights, in part because unruly fans kept hurling Franks onto the field. It wasn't just the throwing, said senior VP John Weber, but the throwing was a little bit of a tipping point. The title of the briefing this week is a stalled dream of self-driving cars. Tech leaders promised we'd be riding in driverless vehicles by now. What happened to the autonomous auto revolution? When did work start on these cars? Almost a century ago, in 1925, an experimental remote control car cruised down Manhattan's Broadway in front of bemused onlookers, only to crash into another vehicle. In the 1950s, the Radio Corporation of America built a prototype highway embedded with wires that could control a car's steering and speed, with the aim of letting drivers relax behind the wheel and giving authorities better control of traffic flows. But officials balked at the cost, up to $200,000 per lane mile. Interest in self-driving cars accelerated, along with advances in computing and wireless communications. And from 2010 to 2021, auto and tech giants such as Google and General Motors collectively spent an estimated $100 billion on driverless vehicles. Yet despite grand promises from industry leaders like Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who in 2016 called autonomous driving basically a solved problem, no self-driving system has yet achieved the goal of full automation, driving to any destination without any human input. This may, in fact, never be possible, said Raghunathan Rajkumar, a professor of computer engineering at Carnegie Mellon University, or it is at least many years or decades away. In a sign of the difficulty of making self-driving cars a reality, Apple last week killed its decade-old autonomous electric car project. How do self-driving cars work? Most autonomous driving systems include those, including those developed by Google's Waymo division and GM's Cruise, use cameras, radar, and LIDAR, light detection and ranging, sensors to construct a 3D map of a vehicle's surroundings. Tesla is an exception. Its vehicles rely solely on cameras. Data collected on board sensors and cameras is fed into an artificial intelligence model that directs the vehicle and decides the best and safest way to navigate around obstacles, including other cars and pedestrians. But while humans are generally good at dealing with the unexpected, the AI must be taught how to react to countless potential hazards, which has slowed the evolution of the technology. How should a driverless car respond, for example, if a dog runs into the road, or if a bicyclist is wobbling dangerously, or if snow obscures white line markings? The problem is that there isn't any test to know if a driverless car is safe to operate, said Mike Ramsey, an analyst at market researcher Gartner. Is the technology safe? The industry says self-driving cars are up to 7 times less likely to get into crashes, leading to injury, than normal cars, which means the technology could help cut the U.S.'s 43,000 annual road deaths. That seems to make sense because AI doesn't drink and drive and never dozes off. But road users in cities where driverless vehicles are being tested say the cars often behave erratically, such as by braking inappropriately and failing to move aside for emergency vehicles. A string of accidents has also dented confidence in the industry's safety claims. In 2018, Elaine Hertzberg became the first pedestrian to be killed by a self-driving vehicle after she was hit by an Uber test car in Tempe, Arizona. It's thought the car became confused when Hertzberg stepped into the road while pushing a bicycle with bags on its handlebars, an array of objects it couldn't interpret. And last fall, a woman in San Francisco was left critically injured after she was hit by a human-driven car and knocked into the path of a Cruise robo-taxi. The taxi attempted a pullover maneuver and dragged the pedestrian for 20 feet. Soon after, California revoked Cruise's permit to operate fully driverless vehicles on the state's roads, and Cruise CEO Kyle Vaught who a month earlier had claimed concerns over the technology were being sensationalized, resigned. Have there been other accidents? Since 2019, at least 17 deaths and 736 crashes have been linked to Tesla's autopilot, driver assistance technology that falls far short of full automation, according to National Highway Traffic Safety Administration data. Drivers are told to keep their hands on the wheel and stay observant when autopilot is engaged, but many don't. Tesla's full self-driving FSD system, which is supposed to guide the car almost anywhere, has also been connected to at least one death. In 2022, Tesla recruiter Hans von Ohain was killed when his Model 3 suddenly veered off a Colorado mountain road, smashed into a tree, and burst into flames. A passenger who survived the crash said FSD had been engaged. Damage to the vehicle meant authorities couldn't confirm that claim. What comes next? Driverless robo-taxis are now available for hire in cities such as San Francisco, Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Wuhan, China. But Waymo and Cruise are thought to be scaling back expansion plans after racking up huge losses. You'd be hard-pressed to find another industry that's invested so many dollars in R&D and that has delivered so little, said engineer Anthony Lewandowski, an early pioneer of self-driving tech. Still, the consultancy McKinsey estimates the market for autonomous driving systems could be worth $400 billion by 2035, as many companies remain eager to replace their human drivers, who can get sick and need to be paid wages, with machines. For now, public distrust remains a major barrier to the technology's spread and success. Journalist Cade Metz likened his ride last year in a Cruise robo-taxi to being in the car with his 16-year-old daughter when she was learning to drive. But more unnerving, he said, because my daughter could at least respond to my moments of panic. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Ozempic's trillion-dollar fiscal threat. Ozempic isn't just a miracle weight loss drug, said Brian Deese, Jonathan Gruber, and Ryan Cummings. It's also a major budgetary threat, part of a new class of drugs called GLP-1 receptor agonist. Ozempic, Wegovy, and similar medications curb appetite and create major weight loss, and thus can be highly beneficial to people with obesity-related health problems. But these drugs cost about $15,000 per year, and public health insurance plans usually only cover them for patients with type 2 diabetes. If coverage is expanded to include the 40% of Americans who are obese, it could cost the government more than $1 trillion per year. That staggering sum is more than the entire Medicare budget. Restricting access to these drugs is growing extremely difficult to defend, as studies show they can significantly reduce the risk of heart disease and other serious illnesses if taken indefinitely to keep weight off. In the U.S., Ozempic costs about 10 times more than in Britain or France. Before costs explode, Congress needs to authorize Medicare to negotiate with Big Pharma to cut the price of these game-changing drugs by at least two-thirds. Medicaid could then follow suit. Otherwise, we'll create one of the biggest fiscal problems of the decade. When women kill their abusers. On the day Devin Gray shot her boyfriend in 2017, said Elizabeth Flock, he'd fired a gun at her, pistol whipped her, and strangled her with a hose. For years, he'd isolated her in a rural Alabama trailer and beaten and terrorized her nearly every day. Finally, Gray waited until he lay down and shot him. A judge rejected Gray's self-defense claim under Alabama's Stand Your Ground law, and she was sentenced to 15 years for manslaughter. My study of hundreds of cases like Gray's has shown that the criminal justice system frequently fails women who use a weapon to defend themselves from chronic abusers. Self-defense laws, written for male property owners, not female domestic violence victims, require a threat to be imminent. But women usually cannot defend themselves at the moment larger, stronger males are abusing them. So they strike later and are treated as criminals. Even when there have been years of abuse, prosecutors often insist that a female defendant's fear of her partner was unreasonable. We need better laws and a better understanding of domestic violence so that cops and prosecutors stop punishing victims who resort to violence to survive. This column comes from South Africa. Cattle ships reek of animal cruelty. Packing live animals onto a boat and shipping them around the globe is barbaric, said Ozair Patel. Every year, millions of sheep, cows, pigs, and goats are transported by sea to foreign countries. These journeys are longer now because Houthi attacks in the Red Sea have rerouted cattle boats around Africa. The animals suffer tremendously on their multi-week voyages, enduring heat, dehydration, filth, overcrowding, and motion sickness. Some die en route or have to be slaughtered upon arrival. Cape Towners got a whiff of the problem recently when a livestock ship carrying 19,000 cattle from Brazil to Iraq docked at the port city to resupply. A putrid stench wafted over the city, so foul that authorities suspected a sewer line breakdown before tracing the source to the ship. When South African animal welfare workers boarded the vessel, they found animals in a terrible state. Cows had been lying in urine and feces in cramped holding pens, their coats coated with muck. Some of the animals had to be put down on the spot, while others were in severe distress. When the wretched ship finally sailed off, Cape Towners could breathe freely again, but the cows faced another two grueling weeks on the waves. It's time to end the practice of shipping livestock by sea. And the last word, our feature article, a pet that couldn't be tamed. Austin Riley raised Waylon the warthog from birth, said Peter Holly in Texas Monthly. Then one day, the 250-pound animal decided to kill him. By the age of 30, a time when most people are just beginning to think about their mortality, Austin Riley had already conquered his fear of death. He'd come exceedingly close to dying on multiple occasions, including a few months before his first birthday, when doctors discovered a golf ball-sized tumor growing inside his infant skull. He would go on to spend much of his childhood in and out of hospitals, enduring high-risk brain surgeries and grueling recoveries. Then, in his mid-20s, he was nearly killed by a brain hemorrhage that arrived one night without warning, unleashing the worst pain he'd ever felt. He emerged from that experience reborn, feeling lucky to be alive and convinced that his life had been spared by God. So as he sat in a pool of his own blood on a beautiful October evening in 2022, He couldn't help but acknowledge the morbid absurdity of his current predicament. He'd spent decades conquering brain injuries only to be killed while doing mundane chores on his family's 130-acre hill country ranch in Bourne, Texas. After all I'd been through, he said, I just couldn't believe that this was how it was going to end. As he slumped against a fence and his mangled body began to shut down, Austin's mind went into overdrive. He thought about his girlfriend, Kennedy, whom he'd never get a chance to marry, and the children he'd never be able to raise. He thought about how much he loved his parents and how badly he wished he could thank them for the life they'd provided. He thought about the land that stretched out before him, a rustic valley accentuated by crimson and amber foliage that seemed to glitter in the evening light, and realized it had never seemed more beautiful than it did in that moment. But mostly he thought about the animal that had just used its razor-sharp 7-inch tusk to stab him at least 15 times. The attack had shredded his lower body and filled his boots with blood, and then left gaping holes in his torso and neck. Had any other animal been responsible, Austin would have considered it a random attack. But this was a pet he'd trusted more than any other, his lovable 5-year-old warthog, Waylon. For years, that animal trusted me every day, and I trusted him, Austin said. I put blood, sweat, and tears into his life, and he decided to kill me. Austin, who spends most days on his own, working with his hands, feels like a throwback from another era. Ruggedly handsome, with a 5 o'clock shadow and a head full of unkempt brown hair, he favors beaten-up boots and Wrangler jeans, and looks like he could have stepped out of a 70s Marlboro ad, though he's partially paralyzed on his left side from a botched brain surgery decades earlier. He has a confident strut and refers to himself as farm boy strong. When it comes to animals, a softer side emerges. Animals have been a part of Austin's life for as long as he can remember. Because of the threat of a seizure stemming from a traumatic brain injury, Austin wasn't allowed to play organized sports, nor could he roughhouse at the swimming pool each summer or attend sleepovers at friends' homes. He did have access to something that other children lacked, however, exotic animals. While other kids had dogs and cats, Austin had a pet ostrich, a whitetail and a fallow deer, hogs, a mastiff, a lab, and a dachshund, all of whom followed the little boy around the ranch. Austin's father, Shane, spent much of his career working in oil and gas when Austin was young, but his passion was for his ranch, which he stocked with unusual animals from faraway places. After Austin's second brain surgery, his parents decided to relocate to their hill country homestead full-time. He was never inside and didn't like to play video games, Gay O'Reilly, Austin's mother recently recalled. He wanted to be outside with the animals, hanging out, playing hide-and-seek, learning how to feed and care for them. Austin loved the animals, and the animals always seemed to love him. But there was one animal that Austin poured more of himself into than any other, Waylon. Their bond formed on a cold day, December night in 2017, seconds after the tiny warthog took its first breath. The piglet's mother had died in labor, but Austin immediately assumed her place, cradling the hamster-sized infant in one hand and a bottle of milk in the other. Austin decided to name the rambunctious warthog as an homage to another unruly figure, outlaw country legend Waylon Jennings. I just kind of became his parent, his dad, really, Austin said. Early on, I'd take him with me through the drive-thru at Whataburger, and he'd sit in the front seat, happy as can be. Waylon soon grew to be 250 pounds of pure protein, as Austin likes to say, more than an average-size NFL linebacker. By then, Austin had moved him to a large pen a few hundred yards away from the family home. On particularly beautiful days, he liked to lie on the ground in the enclosure, listening to sports radio and watching the clouds pass by. Inevitably, Waylon would lie down beside him, gingerly resting his enormous wart-covered head on Austin's thigh. They could remain that way for 5 or 6 hours at a time. The notion that a warthog could be a friendly sidekick can be traced to Pumbaa, the lovable Lion King character known for popularizing the phrase Hakuna Matata, a Swahili expression meaning no worries. On a ruthless African savanna, however, where warthogs are native, they exist in an almost perpetual state of worry. Their wariness and quick trigger have helped to turn them into formidable opponents for some of the world's most fearsome predators. Warthogs' lower tusks protrude from muscular jaws like blades of a scythe chariot. Adding to their terror is the reality that a warthog stab wound isn't a clean form of penetrative trauma. The tusks' hook design ensures they cause even more damage coming out than going in. Despite their menacing appearance and deadly hardware, warthogs typically display limited aggression toward humans. But unlike domestic animals, which have been bred for generations to exhibit behaviors that humans deem favorable, wild animals are capable of dramatic shifts in behavior, even when they appear tame. On the October evening that he almost killed Austin, Waylon greeted Austin at the front gate of his pen, happily accepted some back scratches, and trotted beside him to a nearby feeding trough. About 20 minutes after he'd arrived, Austin had just finished feeding Daisy, a pot-bellied pig he'd owned since he was a piglet, in an adjacent pen. He re-entered the warthog enclosure and was walking toward his all-terrain vehicle, parked at the entrance of the pen. Suddenly, his right leg crumpled behind him, and he found himself tumbling forward, landing some 15 feet away. As he gathered his bearings, Wayland's bulky gray head emerged from a swirling cloud of dust near his feet. Before Austin could stand up and run, Wayland thrust his face between the rancher's lower legs and began violently swinging his tusks back and forth. One tusk stabbed Austin twice in the right calf, another stabbed him once in the left calf. His right leg was gashed from the knee to his upper thigh, an injury so wide Austin was later able to put his hand inside it. Before Austin could fight back, Waylon had hooked his owner four more times in the upper left leg and genitals. Several more stab wounds to his upper right leg followed in rapid succession. Instinctively, Austin grabbed onto Waylon's tusks, slicing open his wrist. After three more gashes in his abdomen, Austin tried to put Waylon in a headlock, but the animal jerked up, plunging his tusk into Austin's voice box, leaving a quarter-size hole in the neck from which a piece of an artery dangled like a grisly necklace. At that point, I just knew I couldn't let him hit my head or get on top of me, Austin said. That's what I kept thinking. Somehow, when he needed it most, Austin caught a break. Lying on his back and bleeding out, he might have looked dead to Waylon. The warthog relented momentarily. Pumped full of adrenaline, Austin staggered to his feet and clambered halfway up an 8-foot fence using a foothold. It would take 5 tries to swing his body over the top. Once outside the pen, Austin made a disheartening discovery. His phone had fallen out of his back pocket. Afraid he'd lose consciousness soon, Austin realized survival depended on him re-entering the pit with the beast and crossing 20 feet of blood-soaked dirt to retrieve his phone and call for help, all without Waylon noticing. Once Waylon had trotted a little ways in the other direction, Austin seized his opportunity. After climbing down the fence, he dragged himself over to his phone and then stumbled to a nearby gate. Steadying his legs and trying not to panic, he struggled to open 2 latches as Waylon circled back around and started charging. Slipping past with moments to spare, Austin collapsed on the ground as the warthog lunged at him from the other side of the fence, threatening to break through. He almost looked like he was possessed, Austin recalled, like he'd turned evil. Austin knew his survival was far from assured. His service rarely worked near the back of Waylon's pen, but on this day he was shocked to find a single bar of coverage. For Austin, it felt like a miracle. As his dad picked up the phone moments later, Austin told him he was bleeding out. When he made it to his son, Shane's first instinct was to push the tissue back inside Austin's body, as if trying to put his son back together. Doctors would later tell the Riley family that by the time Austin reached University Hospital in San Antonio, 30 minutes away, he'd lost nearly half his blood. Any more, they assured relatives, and he would have died. Even more shocking was the fact that Waylon's tusks had come within millimeters of severing multiple arteries. It would take doctors 10 surgeries to keep Austin alive. More than a year after the attack, Riley still has no idea what caused his favorite animal to turn on him. Waylon's pen mate, an easygoing female warthog named Peaches, wasn't in heat, and Waylon wasn't being cornered when he was attacked. Extensive therapy has helped Austin work through traumatic memories and flashbacks that plagued him for the first year after the attack. He is grateful that he didn't stop fighting, not just because he gave himself another shot at life, but because, in a twisted Texas warrior sort of way, he survived an encounter with an animal that is built to battle lions. How many individuals can say that? The day after the attack, Austin's parents asked a family friend to execute Waylon. After the killing, Waylon's head was cut off and sent to a lab so he could be tested for rabies. The results came back negative. His slaughter was partly an act of revenge, but also an acknowledgement that the warthog could never be allowed around humans again. Shane and Gail deleted all photos of the animal from their phones. Unwilling to be in the presence of a warthog ever again, Austin had Peaches relocated to another ranch. Recently, Austin began walking through the warthog's former pen multiple times each day to feed Daisy, the pot-bellied pig. During our last meeting, he showed me his phone, where he'd saved hundreds of images and videos of Waylon. He told me it had been a while, but he had finally found himself able to look at some of them again. Gradually, feelings of shock and betrayal are being replaced by acceptance and understanding, he explained. As we looked at the sweet-natured pictures of the pig and his owner, trading nuzzles and belly scratches, I asked Austin if he thinks Waylon regretted attacking before he was killed. He went silent for a few seconds, mulling over my question before responding. "I don't think it was Waylon who attacked me," he said. "I was attacked by a warthog." This was adapted from a story that first appeared in Texas Monthly. Read one of the making money articles today. The Benjamins. Is it time to retire the $100 bill? The $100 bill only exists for two types of people, said Timothy Noah in the New Republic. Organized criminals and rich tax evaders. Few honest people actually need to keep their dollars in large denominations. Most ATMs don't even dispense anything above a $20 bill. But there are now more $100 bills in circulation than ones. In 2022, the U.S. printed more 100s than any other bill. Who is fueling this demand? Crooks who recognize that smaller bills are harder to hide from the authorities. Today, almost 80% of $100 bills reside outside the U.S., largely held by criminals of one kind or another who want to stash their money overseas. The U.S. is printing more Benjamins because it wants its currency to maintain dominance in a criminal market. That's insane. President Nixon in 1969 recalled bills above 500, citing their use in money laundering. Europe got rid of its 500 euro notes, a favorite of criminals, 8 years ago. It's past time we followed these examples and recalled hundreds, too. Big bills are hard to get rid of for ordinary purchases, said Oyin Adedoyin in the Wall Street Journal. Many people dislike paying with hundreds because of the suspicion they attract. Cashiers hate them. Many stores no longer keep enough cash to break $100 on smaller items. And when cashiers do accept them, they hold up the checkout lines to verify they aren't counterfeits. On the other hand, the ease of hoarding and hiding larger bills suits them to criminal activities. Even criminals who gravitated to cryptocurrencies are returning to hard cash, said Oliver Bullough and Mother Jones. As checks on digital money transfers have become more onerous, criminals have gone back to the one form of currency that can't be found on a spreadsheet. And if you have a lot of currency to move in secret, you want it to weigh as little and take up as little space as possible. $1 million in hundreds weighs 22 pounds, much easier to hide than a 110-pound collection of 20s. Maybe we should curb the printing of all denominations, said Lloyd Lee in Business Insider. After all, cash has fallen behind both credit cards and debit cards as Americans' preferred method of payment. Yet Federal Reserve data shows that the volume of currency in circulation has only increased since 2002, from 22.9 billion notes to 54.1 billion. Cash remains important for many consumers, including a segment of the population that is underbanked or has to rely on alternative financial services. But economists have doubts about where most of the demand for cash is coming from. Accommodating the demands for $100 bills is penny-wise and pound-foolish, said Harvard's Kenneth Rogoff, given its role in facilitating tax evasion and crime. And on the Talking Point page, we have the article referenced by the cover drawing. Polarization. The gender gap becomes a chasm. Men are not from Mars and women are not from Venus, said Elizabeth Grace Matthew in The Hill. But politically, they increasingly inhabit what might as well be different planets. Ideological differences between the two sexes are nothing new. American men have long tended to identify as moderately more conservative and Republican than women. But a new Gallup poll shows that young women are skewing much further to the left than in previous generations. Some 40% of women ages 18 to 29 now identify as liberal, compared with 25% of men, a gender gap that's grown fivefold since 2000. Only 21% of young women say they're conservative, compared with 29% of young men. And because the political is becoming more personal, a 2021 poll found 71% of Democratic college students wouldn't date someone with opposing views. This gender polarization could accelerate an already concerning decline in marriage and fertility. It's no mystery why women are moving left, said Catherine Jeezer Morton in New York Magazine. Conservatives, after all, want to roll back feminism and the control women have achieved over their careers, relationships, and bodies. But the legacy of those feminist victories can now be causing a growing number of Gen Z men to embrace the right. These men hear often about their gender privilege, yet see women outperforming them in school. And because they were literally born yesterday, the idea that women started from a position of inferiority doesn't seem believable. Progressivism won't admit that young white males have any particular social difficulties, said Michael Brendan Doherty in National Review. But conservative influencers like Jordan Peterson can pull them in with a spin on progressive grievance culture, telling these men how they are devalued, ignored, and impugned. Gender polarization isn't simply an American phenomenon, said David French in the New York Times. It's happening in almost every country because the modern world requires us to pour our hearts into our jobs, leaving less time for socializing and romantic relationships. Meanwhile, young people spend ever more time online, where they self-segregate around male or female-focused content that only reinforces their gender-specific beliefs. The longer young men and women live apart, the more those differences will grow, and the harder it will be to ultimately form the relationships that our society needs to prosper. McConnell, A History-Changing Legacy. Mitch McConnell suffered a concussion in a fall last year and then froze mid-sentence and gazed into space during two alarming speeches. So, at 82, his announcement last week that he was stepping down as the Senate Republican leader in November was no real surprise. But make no mistake, said Julian Zielzer in CNN.com, it's also an unconditional surrender to Trumpism. I have many faults, McConnell said. Misunderstanding politics is not one of them. In McConnell's party, MAGA populism has supplanted Reagan conservatism, a reality driven home by the embarrassingly large number of GOP defections on an aid package to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan that McConnell strongly supported. It's well known he despises Trump, said Jonathan Martin in Politico, and the feeling is mutual. But McConnell frittered away his best chance to prevent a Trump comeback by not even trying to gather enough Republican votes to convict Trump at his impeachment trial for inciting the January 6 attack. Good riddance, said John Nichols in The Nation. McConnell is a profoundly cynical partisan who exploited filibuster rules to block legislation with broad popular support, such as gun and campaign finance reform. His longest-lasting legacy will be enabling the fall of Roe v. Wade, first by preventing Barack Obama in the final year of his presidency from replacing the late conservative Justice Antonin Scalia, and then when liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died with weeks left in Trump's term, shamelessly racing to confirm Trump's pick of Amy Coney Barrett. Still, given what will follow, liberals are going to miss him, said Jim Newell in Slate. McConnell rejected Trump's 2020 election lies and resisted the GOP's shift toward isolationism and abandoning allies. His post likely will go to a MAGA hack like Steve Daines of Montana, who thinks Trump can do no wrong. McConnell leaves a formidable legacy of achieving Republican goals, said Kimberly A. Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. Laser-focused on getting 51 votes, he remade the Supreme Court and federal judiciary, passed the Trump tax cuts, preserved the filibuster, and effectively used it. Yes, his failure to limit the massive growth in federal spending enabled many conservatives to cast him as a rhino, but history will remember the longest-serving party leader in Senate history as a master of politics who relished his role as the Democrats' waking nightmare. And a few of the shorter notes. More than 1 billion of the world's 8 billion people are obese, including 159 million children and teens. According to a new study, obesity rates among children and adolescents have quadrupled since 1990 and doubled among adults, with the highest rises in low and middle income countries. Authorities in California seized 62,000 pounds of smuggled fentanyl last year, up from 5,300 pounds in 2021. The 2023 seizures are enough to potentially kill the global population nearly twice over, said California Governor Gavin Newsom. Some 86,000 infants were born in the U.S. in 2021 through IVF and other assistive reproductive technologies. That's about 2% of all births. More than 40% of Americans say they or someone they know has used IVF or similar treatments. More than 125,000 high-income Americans, including 25,000 who make over $1 million a year, did not file tax returns in at least 1 year from 2017 to 2022, according to the Internal Revenue Service. The IRS has collected about $500 million in overdue taxes since launching a crackdown on wealthy tax cheats in 2023. More than 125,000 high-income Americans, immigrants make up about 18% of the American workforce, according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Nearly a third of construction and mining workers and three-quarters of farm workers are migrants. On the poll watch, 56% of Americans, including 72% of Democrats and 45% of Republicans, have a very or somewhat unfavorable view of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Only 17% of all adults and 28% of Republicans have a very or somewhat favorable view of McConnell. And we'll finish out today's program with a quote from Judge Learned Hand, quoted in the Bulwark, who says, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can even do much to help it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.